we had the time, that I could sit down and get a little story from each one of you and hear what God has done in your life. But since that's impossible, I think I'd like to share a little bit out of my life, just so we kind of know where we're coming from and what my background has been. I didn't come from a Christian home. My parents were divorced twice. I was the rare opportunity of marrying my own parents. But it didn't stay together the second time either. So about all I remember in my childhood was my parents fighting. I think maybe in God's grace it meant that I really believe there must be something better than what I'd seen in my own family. So I think I was a candidate for God in a kind of a definite way. I was looking for something. And so I got interested in high school, and I found a group of Christian young people in Portland, Oregon, that seemed to know what they were talking about. And I said, could you tell me how to know God? It seems like you people do. So they said it was quite simple. So at 18, I accepted Christ. Meant business. I really wanted him to be my Lord. That church was quite an active church. We were out every night. We had a radio broadcast, and we went to hospitals to sing, and we were down on the corner of 3rd and Burnside, down in the tough part of town, once a week on street meetings. And so I got my eye teeth cut pretty early. I started talking in public, and I didn't have any experience at all. And I traveled in Canada with Mr. William Booth Cliburn, who was the grandson of General Booth that founded the Salvation Army. I preached my first sermon in Moose Jaw. I preached, and the next time we had an automobile accident driving to Edmonton during the night. He drove off the road. He went to sleep. And he told me I'd have to preach in his place. He had been advertised there as the Prince of Preachers, grandson of General Booth. I still to this day don't know what in the world possessed him, but they kept him in the hospital. He had his scalp peeled back from the accident. He said, "You'll have to preach, Dwight." So I preached. I guess there were 500 people there. And here I was, 18, brand new convert, had never spoken to anything but a group of young people or on the street. And here I had to speak to 500 people that came to hear a really well-known preacher. I was scared, I tell you. My knees kept congratulating each other the whole time. I still don't have any idea what I said, but the only thing it did was, on that trip, I decided maybe, just maybe, God could use an ignorant little guy like me. So there was a seminary, Baptist Seminary in Portland, and at that time they were only charging $10 a semester for tuition. And I had $10, so I was Christian and I wanted to know the Bible better, so I went to seminary. Second year in seminary, when I was 20, a little church, the Calvary Baptist Church, called me to be their pastor, believe it or not. And I talk about persecuting the saints. I really, the sermons I used to preach, I don't know how in the world I got away with it, but to start preaching 3 sermons a week at 20 without any real background took a miracle, that's all I can say. Well, I finished seminary, and then the war was on. So to be a chaplain, you had to be 24, and you had to have your theological degree. And I had just gotten both. So I think I was the youngest chaplain in the American Army. I went overseas with the American forces and landed on the invasion coast of France shortly after D-Day. And I was with the 8th Infantry Division most of the time over there until the end of the war. So I saw something in Germany, particularly, that I thought was an opportunity for the gospel, because, as you well know, they were politically minded. up to the hilt and to have their political ideal crushed and discover that it was all hollow, I felt it was a good chance to get in on the ground floor of that rebuilding nation and get the gospel across. So I wanted to go back and went back to college a while after the war, but landed in Edinburgh, Scotland in 1950. I went there to finish my doctorate. And while I was there, Major Thomas, without knowing me at all, invited me to come and speak at Capenray Hall. And I was looking for a way to do the job in Europe, and I didn't know anybody. And here there was a bunch of German young people there, and I could see that they were being reached and trained, and I was impressed. So I decided that was what God wanted, so I landed in Germany in 1953, and then spent the next 22 years there. And we had the joy of establishing the second Torchbearer Center. The first one was Capenray Hall in England, and ours was Klostermühle in Germany. Have you heard of Klostermühle? It's a German-speaking school, and in the meantime, I had learned the language pretty well. And kind of interesting the way we got that center, Columbia Bible College in South Carolina, Columbia, South Carolina, had Major Thomas speaking there, and they had a missionary project for the students every year, and the students gave money to that project. They chose different things to do for missions, so they asked him if he had any mission, and he said, we've got work in Germany, but we don't have a center. So they made that their project for the year, and the students gave about $9,000, and with that money we leased the property of Klostermühle and started there in 1958. And I'm sure Major Thomas at that time didn't see how this would develop, but shortly after that we got another center in Austria. Then we got one in Sweden, then we got one in Spain, then we got a second one in Germany, and a second one in Austria. And I guess you know we have 19 centers now around the world, Australia, New Zealand. I've been in nearly all of them, the new ones. There's one in India now and one in Indonesia. But I think it's great that about 2,000 young people just like yourselves are graduating from our short-term Bible schools every year. And I know they're infiltrating society because everywhere I go, when I tell them that I've been working with torchbearers, I almost always find somebody's heard about them or somebody's sent some of their friends there or they know something about it. So it hasn't been a very high-powered thing. They don't advertise much, but lives that are producing, fruitful lives, have a way of getting to be known and duplicating themselves. So 1975, this property, Johnny Merchant heard about the torchbearers and said that she had 200 acres of land and a chapel on it, just about this size, and 14 buildings. And she said if the torchbearers would like to come and start another center here, that she'd be glad to have us, let us have it. So I came here in 75, stayed here 2 years. Ron Turpin was here with me. And after that, I went up to Oregon. Well, first I went to California. I was dean of Simpson College, Alliance College in Modesto, California. Then went up to Albany, and there I am now. We just started a new church in January. We had about 45 people there last Sunday, yesterday. And we're having the excitement. I've never done that before, never started a church before. It's hard work, incidentally. Don't kid yourself if you want to start a new church. It takes a lot of work. So that brings me up to date. And I thought maybe you'd like to know how we've been identified with torchbearer work in a wonderful way, really, through the years. And it's just a great thrill for me to be here and come back and see all of you here and see God is continuing to use this place for His glory. Any questions about that? Well, What I'd like to do is spend a little time with you, at least on this subject of a man-to-man ministry. We don't have a lot of time for it, and I want to get through 1 Peter with you. But I think maybe I'll do that as kind of an introductory thing tonight, in this first hour. Do you really know what man-to-man ministry is? Would you be able to appreciate what John meant when he says in 3 John, he says, I have no greater joy than to hear that my children walk in the truth. I would like to have you have that great joy. Because I doubt if all of you will be preachers. I doubt if all of you will be evangelists. But one thing I know, if you are Christians and you settle anywhere, there will be some faithful people who are ready to be taught and who will not be productive unless they are taught. And I don't know if you've ever noticed the Great Commission in Matthew. Do you know the difference between the Great Commission in Mark and the one in Matthew? Do you ever notice it? Mark says, go and preach the gospel. Let's see. How does it say it? I can't remember exactly how Mark's goes. I guess somebody could look it up. It's in the last chapter. And in Matthew, it says, preach the gospel to every creature, teaching them to observe all things whatsoever I have commanded you. And I don't think we've done a very good job of that second part. I believe that we have assumed that if people go to church, they will become disciples. Go ye into all parts of the world, preach the gospel to every creature, teaching them to observe. Actually, the word is disciple them. All the things that I have said to you. Did it ever occur to you that the Lord Jesus Christ, the Son of God, spent most of his time with 12 men? Wouldn't you have thought he had something more important to do? And if he thought it was worthwhile to work with 12 for 3 years, I would imagine that it could be worthwhile for you to work with one person maybe for 1 year. The verse I would like to have you memorize, because it will help you keep the concept in mind, is 2 Timothy 2:2. Anybody know it already? Second Timothy 2:2. Somebody read it. You ought to be able to remember the place anyway. 2:2:2. 2 Timothy 2:2. I'm going to ask you to recite it for me tomorrow night, so and I'm going to have your name listed right here, so we'll see if you'll take your first assignment. 2 Timothy 2:2, let's hear it. What translation is that? What version? New American? King James, the things that thou hast heard of me among many witnesses, the same commit thou to faithful men who shall be able to teach others also. How many generations of believers do you have in that one verse? How many? Three. What are the three? Paul? Timothy? Faithful men? And others? Four. And the Greek there, you actually could get one more. When he says, the things that thou hast heard of me among many witnesses, could also mean through many witnesses. He might have been saying, there have been witnesses that taught me. Could be. So you got witnesses, Paul, faithful men, No, witnesses Paul, Timothy, faithful men, and others. Paul writes the letter to Timothy. Timothy is his son in the faith. What would happen if this class, everybody in it had five generations? You say, well, multiply 38 times 5. No, no, no. It would be much more than that. You have a power at your disposal that has infinite possibilities. Did you know that? The best illustration I know of it is rice. I suppose you've heard this maybe before. If you had a chessboard and you put one grain of rice on the first square, do you know how many squares on a chessboard? Nobody plays chess? No. What'd you say? 64. Right. I thought you said 54. Okay, 64 squares, eight each way. And you put one grain of rice on the first square, and you put two on the second, and four on the third, and eight on the fourth, and 16 on the fifth, and 32 on the sixth, and 64 on the seventh. About how much rice would you have on the 64th square? Anybody got an idea? Well, it's been estimated, and it's not too hard to do, because you can take a square inch and see how many grains of rice will go in a square inch, and then you can multiply times how much it takes for a square yard, so you can figure out about how many grains of rice it would take. They say there would be enough rice on the 64th square to cover India to a depth of 6 feet with rice. And it started with one grain. All you do is have one grain and double it. And you take two and double it. So how does it work? Well, you find your first convert and you stay with him until he's able to find his first convert. And when he goes to find his first one, you go find your second one. Then there are four, and you do it once more, and there are eight. You do it once more, and there are 16. And you'll have... How many will you have? And it all starts with one person being saved. How many Christians do you think there are in the whole wide world? Would you like to estimate? I know the Southern Baptists in America have 14 million members. I wouldn't dare say they're all born again, but they're at least enough that they declare themselves to be part of a church, and that's one denomination. So what shall we say? Let's say, let's make it a small enough number that we're absolutely certain we've got them. Let's say in the whole world, 1 million Christians. Genuine, born again, spirit-filled children of God. Have we got a? You think we got 1 million? 14 million Baptists. There ought to be a few saved ones among the Mennonites. How many do you think there are in the world? I mean, we're talking about one denomination in America. And I mean, there are plenty of Christians in Europe, and lots of them. I mean, South America, the church is booming. Africa, there's a new church formed. I've heard the statistics, I've forgotten now, but a church the size of maybe 500 coming into existence every day in Africa right now. And they're having revival in a number of places. A lot of hidden Christians in the Iron Curtain countries, in China. I know we've got 1 million genuine Christians. Haven't we? Everybody agree? Well, if those million, and we got them, if they would win 12 people, but not only win them, train them so that they can do the same thing for somebody else, just do the same thing that was done for them, by the time you've got the 12th person reached, you have every man, woman, and child on earth converted. Have we got the million? Yes. Is it a superhuman task to win 12 people and train them? No. So, what are we going to do about it? Actually, you don't need a lot if you actually are doing the job of training. And Jesus knew that, and that's why he said, teaching them to observe all things whatsoever I have commanded you. So I'm glad you're here, and I hope what I'd like to do, maybe you've already thought about this, but I would hope that in the few sessions we have with you, that you get a vision of the possibilities of one person. And incidentally, did you realize that Jesus is the one who puts the accent on a single person? That some of the greatest messages he ever preached were preached to one person. I noticed a little thing the other day, well, a while back, but how many books are in the New Testament because somebody thought that one person was worth writing a theological letter to him? How many letters in the New Testament written to one man? Anybody know? Can you think of any? First and Second Timothy, Titus. Huh? Yeah. Jude? You left out two important ones. Huh? Acts and Luke were written to Theophilus. Read it. It's in the first verse of both books. O noble Theophilus, think what we would have missed if Dr. Luke had not thought that Theophilus was important enough to give him an account of how the church started on the day of Pentecost and how it developed, how the gospel spread through Paul the Apostle. Think what we have missed if we didn't have Luke's gospel. I believe that Luke is... I usually recommend to people to start reading, if they don't know the Bible, start reading Luke, because he was a doctor, and they say his avocation was art. He was an artist. And you see that in Luke. And there are a lot of stories in Luke, very interesting ones, that are not in the other Gospels. And, of course, it starts off very interestingly with the account of Jesus' birth. But Luke's Gospel, written for Theophilus. Somebody thought one man was important. That's why we have those two books. So what I'd like to wean you away from this idea that you only can be a successful Christian worker when you have numbers. I mean, we're infected with the numbers disease. And I'm afraid that very often we skim the surface. We have leave burnt over ground behind us. We leave half-converted people behind us who don't really know how to proceed as Christians and who collapse as soon as they're subjected to the first test. And the reason is because they're not taught. Now, I'm a pastor, and I know that I will never be able to reach all the members of my church and sit down with them and find out where they are and what they need and pray with them about their problems. The only ones I reach are those who have the the determination to come to me and tell me that they need help. Now, that's very few, really. But I've got a lot of spiritual babies in my church that I mean, they come to church on Sunday morning, but I sometimes wonder how much good I do. I've done this. It's a dirty trick, but I've done it. After I've preached on a Sunday morning, I'll go to somebody's house for dinner, and I'll say at the dinner table, somebody tell me what my text was this morning. What did I preach on this morning? They all look at each other. Somebody usually makes a joke, and we have a little laugh. But nobody knows. I mean, there's one person in my church that I know of that brings a notebook and makes notes on what he hears. And I know positively if I ask them a week later, what was it that I was trying to get across a week ago? I doubt if anyone could even tell me what the theme was. And that's the education of young Christians. That's the preparation of them to have their own ministry. That's preparing them to have their own gospel children. I don't see much future in it, really. I don't know about your church. Maybe you've got a better one. Maybe they do a job of training there. Maybe they implant a love for souls and a determination to prepare their own hearts so that they can reach somebody else and train them and give them the essentials so they can walk and live for Christ. Maybe you have that. Praise God. I hope you do. But my experience with the average church, I must say, is rather discouraging. So that's why I'm so delighted that you're here, because you are concentrating for a period of time, and you're far enough away from the press of modern life that you have some time to think, decide what's important, and get a hold of basic New Testament truth. And I'm just afraid that it might be like a lot of other classes. I mean, I went to seminary. I can't remember anything I learned in seminary. I listened a little, but I tried to, when the exam came, you know, I'd dig in and get the answers to the questions, but you asked me a week later what I learned from the exam or what I remembered from it. I never did. And if I hadn't gone to be a pastor when I was 20 in the second year of seminary, I don't think I would have learned anything. But I had to learn when I was out there putting out every week. And so I had to dig in. But you can go through these whole 5 months and come out of here with nothing but an acquaintance with some of the Bible. But Bible knowledge never should be theoretical. Never. Jesus never taught any theory to his disciples. None whatsoever. Everything he taught was practical, down to earth, designed for living, designed to change lives, designed to produce a change in society. Everything. And if that is not your objective in being in this Bible school, if you only want to say, well, I put in my 5 months, and if you're not capable of conveying to anybody else what you've learned while you're here, I'm sorry, but I think you're wasting your time. Now, you probably say, well, you know, I hear this all the time. People say, well, I'm not gifted. I'm not a gifted speaker. I don't know how to talk. But don't tell me that you cannot share with one other person something that has been of life-changing importance in your own life. Don't tell me you can't do that. You don't have to be gifted as a speaker to do that. And that's where it is. That's where it is. I go to seminars. I'm invited to all kinds of things where they concentrate on a certain subject. And you get a smattering that might stick if you spend some hours on a subject, but how much of it really changes me and makes my life more effective, I really wonder. You always get a big notebook with three rings and they present it to you like, this is it now, you just master this and you've got it all. And I suppose the reason we like to do it by classes is because it's a shortcut. It doesn't take any determination, doesn't take any discipline. You just take this book and read it through and you got it. Well, you can't do that in man-to-man ministry. It takes time. It takes love. It takes sharing with somebody, something that's of life importance to you. And if you're not willing to do that, you can coast through life. You might even wind up in the ministry. But if you cannot leave a few faithful men behind you who will be carrying on the next time you see them, then I wonder if all the preaching you do really is going to amount to very much. I believe God blesses preaching, and it ought to be biblical, and it ought to be instructive. But I know that average person sitting in that congregation, usually tired from their week of work, glad to relax a little bit, is not really in a position to learn. So you have a choice opportunity here. And I'm just hoping you don't miss it. Because if you are equipped to take one other person when you leave here to the point where they can do the same thing for somebody else, and don't leave them until they can. I don't know how long it takes. You've set a chain reaction in motion, such as 2 Timothy 2:2. The Apostle Paul writing to his son in the gospel. And I find it's pretty interesting that Paul didn't forget that he had a son in the gospel. He led him to Christ on his trips through Asia Minor. And he never forgot him. And he went back and got him. And he saw that he was a promising young man. And he took him with him and trained him. And now he writes to Timothy and he says, Timothy, the things that thou hast heard of me. He heard a lot from Paul. The same. Commit thou to faithful men, which will be able to affect others also. That's the secret. And you are in a position to be in a chain like that if you're going to do the job that you ought to do in these few months that you're here. The time is up. We now have recess.